The Silver Fox was waiting for me in a back booth at Wan Kyo, the retro, non-chic Cantonese restaurant that was two doors down from the rear entrance to the Essex House on West 56th Street. It was very quiet in Wan Kyo at 4 o'clock on a rainy December afternoon. I paused just inside the door next to the burbling Buddha fountain to remove my trench coat and fedora. Wan Kyo's owner, Benny, who was a burbling Buddha himself, hung up my coat while I helped my basset hound Lulu off with the pert duck-billed rain cap that I'd had made for her by C.C. Filson. Lulu is susceptible to sinus problems in damp weather. Snores like a lumberjack when she gets stuffed up. I know this because she likes to sleep on my head. Benny led me to one of the high-backed wooden booths in back. Wan Kyo was discreetly lit, which is to say dim. It helped keep your eyes from dwelling on the tacky, circa 1957 tiki bar decor. Wan Kyo's extensive menu of tropic cocktails offered such exotic classics as Mai Tais and zombies, but no one went to Wan Kyo to drink. Its lunch and dinner menu featured bygone finger food treasures such as egg rolls and fried wonton with a gooey red sweet and sour dipping sauce, but no one went to Wan Kyo to eat. In fact, no one went to Wan Kyo at all. Wan Kyo was, by unwritten accord, the designated safe haven where literary and theatrical people could meet in public without meeting in public. If, say, a celebrated Broadway star was trying to maneuver his way into, or out of, the bed of a dewy-eyed ingenue, he'd meet her, or him, in a booth at Wan Kyo. If a Hollywood studio executive was in town to try to lure a big-name editor out to the West Coast, they'd talk terms in a booth at Wan Kyo. It was understood that you became legally blind the moment you walked in. If you saw someone there, you didn't see them, and they didn't see you. If you wished to be seen, then you had lunch at the Russian Tea Room, drinks at the Algonquin, or dinner at Elaine's, where I'll have you know that Lulu once had her very own water bowl. But that was way back when the New York Times Sunday Book Review had hailed me as the first major new literary voice of the 1980s. It was 1992 now. Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas just ousted Poppy Bush. In a few weeks, Bill, his wife Hillary, and their daughter Chelsea would be moving into the White House. The 80s were over and out. And so was I. The Silver Fox was seated in the last booth on the left, smoking a Newport, drinking straight bourbon, no umbrella drinks for the fox, and wearing those oversized round glasses of hers that made her look like the world's most devious owl. Her real name was Alberta Price, and she was the top literary agent in New York. My literary agent. She was a tiny woman, barely 5 feet tall and 72 years old that year. Over the course of her 40 years in publishing, she'd represented such luminaries as Norman Mailer, William Styron, Irwin Shaw, Catherine Ann Porter, and Daphne du Maurier. She was known as the Silver Fox because of her sculpted helmet of silver hair, and because she was sly, tough, and brutally honest. I'd been with her since I published my first short story in The New Yorker, back when I was 2 years out of that college up in Cambridge that nobody mentions by name. She'd run her own agency for decades until she accepted a lucrative offer 2 years back to join the Harmon Wright Agency as head of its literary department. It was, she'd informed me at the time, no longer possible for an independent agent to compete with a colossus like HWA, which had offices in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, and Tokyo. I sat across from her. Alberta was wearing a black pantsuit and a white silk blouse. Black and white was the official dress code for all HWA agents. Harmon Wright, who'd been born and raised Heshy Roth in the rough-and-tumble Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, didn't like to see his people in anything else. I wore the chalk-striped navy blue suit that I'd had made for me in London by Strickland and Sons, a pink shirt, and a blue-and-gold striped tie.